Hello, welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Dr. Nick Argyris,
and this is Earth
2.
That's...
I'm Nick Argyris, and I have a question.
Don't listen to them, lit heads. They're bullies. This is how they talk about your children in the classroom, too.
Litheads, maybe we should break the ice here. You know, if you ever wonder what teachers talk about in the teacher lounge, it is your children. Like, that's what we're talking about. We, you know, you might think we're talking about like pedagogy or we're talking about best practices.
I'm sorry,
but we're mostly talking about how some kids are assholes. Like, that's kind of what we talk about.
Joe, I have to differ a little bit. Maybe you teach children. I shape the future leaders of America.
Oh, no. I teach children who need me.
Go on. So much, right, Joe? They need so much from
they need
your,
so
your,
much.
Your
I give
and attention,
and, I
and you
give
and you give and you give.
Give.
That's what you were going
to
say, right?
To my
Hello
students,
and
yes.
Welcome to You Don't Know Lit. My name is Nick Argyris, and this week I am looking for my notes.
Hello, my name is Dr. Ian DeYoung, and Nick, if you're looking for your notes, I have them. I've hidden them in an undisclosed location.
I'm looking for a book that has been faithfully adapted to a wonderful big picture movie screen.
Ooh.
So I hope you guys are up for that challenge. And to help me with this challenge are two high school English teachers, Ian and Joe.
Hey, Nick. My name is Joe Holshue.
Hey, Joe.
Nick, I brought a play. Is that okay? I didn't bring a book. I brought
it's
a
fine.
Play.
Yeah,
it does exist in book form. Like, I teach this in book form in my classroom. Nick, I brought a play called A Streetcar Named Desire, written in 1947, turned into a film, an extremely faithful adaptation, in 1951. In fact, Nick, it was so faithful that all the people that were in the Broadway play, they just put him in the movie. Like they just filmed it.
Well, this works. Let's just move it forward. Yeah.
Hello. My name is Major General Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher. And today, Nick, if you're looking for a book that was faithfully adapted into a film, I would recommend 84 Charing Cross Road, an epistolary memoir, which is a reader recommendation from the loyalist of litheads, Gina. Thank you, Gina, for this recommendation today.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
A memoir. What is it? It's an epistolary memoir.
It's an epistolary memoir. I don't want to Arnold Schwarzenegger myself here or give away too much of my thunder, but it's a really interesting thing, and I'm looking forward to talking about
it. Don't be afraid to give away your thunder.
Yeah.
Epistolary is when it's in journals?
Yeah.
Yes.
Good job. Wow.
Thank you, guys.
And a memoir
and a book has pages, right?
Yes.
Mostly.
It's made of letters. It's made up of letters.
Ah.
Wait, books are made of letters. Nick, he's tricking you. All books are made of letters.
Can I tell you guys, I'm sorry. I just need to tie up a thread from a previous episode. We talked about Bermashave on a recent episode. And after Bermashave, I went down the Wikipedia rabbit hole on defunct companies. And naturally, I found myself researching the DeLorean Motor Company. Now, I just want to share one fact about the DeLorean Motor Company. Well,
all right. This week's facts are brought to you by DeLorean, the motor company defunct in 1987?
82.
Yep, they came back to sponsor this podcast.
Yep,
we are sponsored both by dead celebrities and defunct companies.
Yes, know Lit, sponsored by dead celebrities and dead companies.
the first fact you may already know. So where do we know the DeLorean from? Back to the Future. But by the time that Back to the Future was made, the company was already defunct. So you couldn't watch the movie, man. Say, my goodness, that's a lovely DeLorean. I'd like to buy one new off the lot. It was gone. It was already gone for three years by that point. The better fact is this. The guy who kind of made DeLorean, his last name being DeLorean,
right.
part of the reason that the DeLorean company exploded was because he was involved in a sting operation, and he was caught on tape saying he would bankroll $24 million worth of cocaine smuggled into the U.S.
Very 80s.
He needed money, and so he decided to go the cocaine smuggling route.
Sure.
He was acquitted because apparently he claimed they were entrapping him. But
how hasn't that been a movie yet? Like, oh. I feel like we need money. We could either rob a bank or import a bunch of cocaine, right? Like, I feel like those...
That has been a movie.
Well, that has been a movie.
That might be the most 80s reason for a business closing I've ever heard. That might be the most perfectly 80s bow on top of that company ever.
Yep. Neon bow. So that's all I got to say about DeLorean. I really wanted to share that, and I didn't do that research in time for last week's episode. So here we are.
Well, we really appreciate that. Thank you,
folks. This is what you've come to expect from this podcast. You don't know lit. Mm-hmm. Weeks late research and witty jokes.
Continuity that skips episodes. Yeah, absolutely.
References to things that Nick keeps cutting out, like call forwards.
Or things that haven't happened yet.
Well, welcome everybody to You Don't Know Lit, a weekly podcast where we pick a theme and two podcast. Books. What?
A strongly podcast.
Okay.
A strongly podcast. I'm fine. Let's...
Yep.
We'll pick that up and carry it with us the rest of our lives. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you, Ian.
A strongly podcast where we pick two books and one theme, like that one internet video. We do have some rules on this show, of course. Rule number one, only unavoidable spoiler. Two girls in one cup. That was the joke. Unavoidable spoilers. Rule number two, omit needless words, Joe. Mm-hmm, and rule number three, winning isn't everything. It's the only thing. And I really like how such sore losers you guys are. So what I've noticed after the amount of episodes that we've recorded is that Ian just goes silent.
Uh-huh.
And Joe rips up his notes like a little toddler. Both so beautifully unique and precious.
To be clear, the reason I go silent is partly because I'm a sore loser. Because
I hate this.
Partly
stupid anyway.
Partly because Joe has earned by the sweat of his brow and the movement of his lips the victory. Mm-hmm. And I want him to have his time in the sun.
That's
goodness
very
knows
kind.
He doesn't have many other opportunities for people to pay attention to him.
That's right. That's right. And that's what this is really all about. Joe, we have 30 seconds. Come sit down on our couch.
Oh, Nick. I am ready. Nick, today I have brought you a book, a play, about love. I brought you a book about lust. I brought you a book about abuse and power and machismo. It's about fantasy, reality, sex. It's really about sex and also death. Nice. It's about what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, and what it means when those two things collide. Nick, this week, I think you should watch A Streetcar Named Desire, the 1947 play by Tennessee Williams, 1951 Oscar-winning film by Ilya Kazan. Nick, I have one more thing to say. I have to do it off mic. Stella!
Thank you for not destroying our ears with that.
Yes.
Also, Nick, I have to take issue. I have to take umbrage at your timekeeping. That was like 45 minutes. That was not 30.
No, that was 30. That was a hot 30. That was a tight 30.
Tight 30.
It was just the lists that made it seem long.
It did. Yes. It's actually a rhetorical strategy. Listing things makes it seem like more impressive and like girthier. Like lists accomplish a lot in a very short amount of time.
Did you just say girthier?
I did say big. You didn't bring any girthy lists, Ian.
You might want to reference rule number two, Ian. Sometimes when Joe talks, it just seems like it lasts forever. So with that, Ian, do you want to make this next 30 seconds feel like 10?
Sure. In 1949, Helene Hanf wrote a letter to a bookshop in London asking for cheap, used British classics. The shop answered her letter. She, in turn, responded, and the rest, as they say, is history. This book, published in 1970, 97 pages, reproduces the decades of letter writing between Hanf and the bookshop's people. It is equal parts hilarious, sweet, and sad, and it was made into a film starring Sir Anthony Hopkins.
Ian, why don't you start?
Congratulations, Ian.
I don't understand what you said. What's this book about?
Yeah, so the plot is pretty simple of this book.
Okay, good.
Yeah. So there is this writer. Her name is Helene Hanff, and that's spelled H-A-N-F-F, and that's a hard one to say.
Hanff, yeah.
And she lives in New York, and she's looking for books of British literature. And
Shit.
Why is that surprising to you?
Mm-hmm.
This is very meta.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. The meta gets meta-er. So she writes. No. Okay. She writes. She sees this advertisement.
Does she start a podcast?
In a magazine? No. No, she doesn't. But kind of.
Two assholes.
Sort of. She sort of starts a podcast. If by starting a podcast, we mean she writes a bunch of letters over a 20-year period. Gotcha. She writes.
How many of them?
She writes quite a few. She writes these letters to. She writes a letter to this bookshop, which is advertising inexpensive secondhand British books. They're located in London. She's never been to London. She writes them and says, "Here are the books I like," and they respond to her. And there's one guy in particular, Frank Dole, who responds to her. And she answers the letter, and she's kind of funny and charming, and over time they develop this long distance relationship, her and the people who work at this shop. And so they send her books that she asks for, and she sends them hilarious little letters, and sometimes they joke in their letters back to her. This is also during the time when right after
is
World
this
War,
you've got mail.
That's what I was gonna
is
say is it
mail?
You've got mail.
It's well, it's
answer the question.
I've never seen You've Got Mail.
Okay, well, it's basically this.
Okay, great. But
that's not the faithful adaptation
that it was. No. So this is happening during the post-war period in England. Well, I guess it's World War II, so it's post-war around the world. Mm-hmm. But in England, they were having to do some serious food rationing. One of the things that our main character, our primary letter writer, Helene Hanff, does is she starts sending these people food. Because they can't get like fresh meat or eggs. And so she gets them shipped and they send her gifts. And over the course of time, 20 years, she keeps saying, I'm going to visit. And like they're good friends by now, but she never does. And I'm not going to tell you what happens at the end, but I will say it's sad, but also kind of bittersweet, but sad. It's a downer, folks.
Yeah, Nick, I don't.
We know.
Not to put the cart before the horse, Nick, but my book is also a downer this week.
We need a, yeah. We need a we sound know, effect, like a downer buzzer.
Yeah. Wah.
It would run out of battery.
It would.
Why, we need a buzzer for when it's not a downer. I think that would be of more importance.
Upper.
So it doesn't sound like this does stray a little bit from.
You've Got Mail.
You've Got Mail, yeah, with the food thing.
Yep.
I recently watched almost all of Nora Ephron's movies in a weekend.
Now, why would you do that?
I actually, can I guess why you did that?
Nick, folks, it's time for our favorite game here on You Don't Know Lit. Why did Nick watch nearly all of Nora Ephron's movies in a weekend?
She's a really interesting woman. So in addition to all of the movies that I watched, I also watched the documentary about her. And like, she got famous by basically just being really charming.
Yes.
Wow.
And like she was going to parties with celebrities and like charming their pants off and having them over for dinner, and then like got into the business that way. And like she was obviously an extremely good writer. Mm-hmm. But just very good with words. Anyway, what were you guys talking about? 84.
Yeah.
This came out in 84?
84 Charing Cross Street. Now that's the address that she sends these letters to. That's the address where this bookshop is located. That's really interesting, Nick, that you would kind of recount that, because I have a similar feeling about this author, about Helene Hanff. She wrote some books. She was involved in the early like scripted broadcast TV industry in New York City, but she was mostly just like a really clever, funny New Yorker that everyone knew. She drank a lot of gin and everyone was like, she's the best.
Yeah, you got it.
She sounds like a blast.
She wrote some books and wrote some plays, like a bunch of plays. And it wasn't like I don't think she had kind of the career that Nora Ephron did, because Nora Ephron had some Academy Award nominations. Helene Hanff was just like the New Yorker. And if you knew her, that was good for you, because she was awesome.
Wow. Charisma goes a long way. I think that's one thing that I would like to impart to all of my students. It's just like, look, guys.
What about
like,
our lit heads?
Lit heads. Well, yeah, lit heads. They might know this by now. Lit heads are notoriously charismatic people. But one thing I want to tell students is, look, should you be a good student? Yeah. But you know what's even better than that? Being really likable. it goes a long way.
What didn't you like about this book, Ian? There's a question I have never asked before. What did you hate about this book?
I don't know. Okay, so this is, I'm not going to say I hated it, but this is something which I wonder about. This is an epistolary memoir. It does a really amazing job mashing up maybe two, maybe three genres. So here they are. Let's count them down. Number one, the memoir.
Number one.
As we know, a memoir is where someone tells a focused part of their life story. It's not like, I was born in 1961. It's like, here is a particular part of my life story that I want to share with you. That's the memoir. She also plays with the epistolary narrative, where a variety of letters and telegrams and recordings and other things, journals can piece together a story. Mm-hmm. And the third genre is kind of a weird one, old-fashioned-y, I think, where a collected letters, where somebody dies and you collect all their letters and that gives a sense of who they were. So I have the letters of J.R.R. Tolkien on my shelf because I'm a hopeless nerd. But that's kind of like, those are the three genres, the memoir, the epistolary narrative, and the collected letters. And somehow this book does all three. It's nonfiction. Like, this is not a fictional story. This she actually wrote these letters. She actually had this relationship with these people.
Oh. I did not know
they
that.
Were real life people. This is not fiction. This is not one of your little false lies. This is not a fictional lie.
This is not The Hobbit.
This is not The Hobbit. And this is your Hobbit fact for the week. The Hobbit, as a matter of fact, is not true. It didn't happen.
Oh, Hobbit fact. The Hobbit is false. Hobbit fake.
Hobbit fake. Let's be honest, folks. It's a Hobbit fake.
Okay, so this book is fact, not fiction.
This book is fact, not fiction.
Is this based on a true story?
It is. Or no, is it this... is a true story. That's the thing. She made a memoir made up of letters which actual people actually wrote. It's the kind of thing which really shouldn't work. Like, it ought not to exist. Like, the fact that these letters survived, the fact that she was able to go back over the course of 20 years and pull out all the letters that she had written, the fact that the letters that she had written survived in England, that's an amazing thing.
Yeah, and this is the sort of book, like, if you pitched it to your agent the first time, or if you pitched it to a publisher, they'd be like, what's your second idea? Because this doesn't sound that good.
Right. It shouldn't work. But I'm here to say it really does.
I'm not sure I have my head wrapped around the concept of what's happening.
Okay.
So she wrote letters over 20 years.
Yes.
And then put them all in a book. And who'd she write the letters to?
Well, she wrote them.
Anthony Hopkins?
The character played by Anthony. She saw this advertisement in the magazine for books, and she wrote over to England and said, "Hey, I would like some of your books." And they responded to her, and she developed a correspondence with them, writing letters back and forth. And over time, you know, they kind of like the people she was writing to opened up. She's a very kind of, like I say, clever, witty person. She opened up right away. And so the letters that they exchanged kind of tell the story of their developing relationship. And they paint a picture of her and of the people that she was writing to and the people who were writing to her. And we kind of get a sense of the growth of a friendship over this course of time. And there's kind of a plot arc, too. She develops a friendship, wants to go there, never makes it. And then there's, as I mentioned, a sad conclusion. So,
well, I think we can guess what that is.
Well, but no spoilers, so I'm not technically spoiling it.
Yeah, Nick.
Staying with the letter of the law.
Rhymes with Schmeth.
Does that make more sense, Nick?
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of great sense. Have you seen the movie?
I have. And my goodness, the movie is...
My goodness.
Faithful.
The movie is very so good. Faithful. Okay, so this might seem like a book for a very specific, and a movie for a very specific set of tastes. Those tastes being people who like old books, people who like London, people who like letter writing.
Yeah.
Like
that's what I was thinking too. Right.
It kind of feels like when I started into this, and it was like, okay, this is right up my alley, but probably not right up Nick's. And I actually have a quote from Roger Ebert's review of the movie. I'm gonna read that now. So he says this.
We'll allow it.
Thank you. So he begins the review with, "Miss Fisk might not have liked this movie." And he ends it as follows. "Sigh. Miss Fisk was a librarian at the Urbana Free Library when I was growing up. She instilled such a love of books in me that I still searched used bookstores for The Adventures of the Melody Family by Elizabeth Enright. Those were the first real books I read. Miss Fisk ran the book club and the Saturday morning puppet shows and the book fairs and the story readings. She never had to talk to me about her love of books because she simply exuded it and I absorbed it. She would have loved this movie. Sitting next to her, I suspect I would have loved it too. But Miss Fisk is gone now, and I found it pretty slow going on my own. And for that matter, Miss Fisk had a sharp critical intelligence, and I suspect that after seeing this movie, she would have nodded and said she enjoyed it. But then she might have added, why didn't that silly woman get on the boat and go to London 10 years sooner and save herself all that postage?" Oh. So Roger Ebert is saying, well, this isn't realistic. But the thing is, I disagree with Roger. Sorry, Roger. Sorry, Roger. This is the segment of the show where I apologize to Roger Ebert. I'm sorry, buddy, but I disagree with you. This movie, this book, this story is real life. It is drawn from the actual experiences of this person. And sometimes real life doesn't fit the familiar beats of film. Like, that's what makes the book so good, and it's what makes the movie so good. It feels real. It's not just for people who like old books or London or letter writing. This movie, this book, the story, it's for people who have regrets, people who have unexpected friendships, people who don't appreciate what they have until it's gone, people who have kind of make mistakes, who have human nature.
This feels like one of those book movies that is this going to make you want to reach out to that old friend?
Or make a new friend or start writing letters?
I think all of the above.
All of the above.
Yeah. Okay. It's the kind of thing where like she's not like heartbroken by the end. She's like kind of, I mean, she's a wise old gin drinking New Yorker. She knows what's what. She knows like she made the choices she made and it happened. But there is regret, and I think there is a feeling of like you gotta grab life with both hands, as our sponsors this week, Dodge Ram, would say. You have to grab life by the horns,
right?
Yeah,
make hay while the sun shines.
Yeah, sponsored by hay this week too. That too.
I really just want to talk about Nora Ephron. Well, it sounds like the opposite of every one of her movies, which is where things absolutely work out.
But like instead of wine, she drinks gin, and instead of writing like happy movies, she writes like tragic, like sweet but tragic films.
It's bittersweet. Yeah.
It's not.
That's the thing, though. It's not tragic because there's a value to a really, really good friendship, and I think that's one of the things that this book does. It writes this friendship down, and so you have the letters, and you can see that it was a real thing. We have the book, and the book means that this friendship survived beyond the lives of these people, which is kind of cool.
Why is this a good adaptation? You've seen the movie.
I have, yeah. So there's a moment in the book where she sends some scripts to Frank Dowell, who is her main correspondent, and he's like, "These are great. I wish you could write for English TV. It wants livening up a bit." He says it's not very fun. The first adaptation of this book was broadcast on English TV on the BBC, which is kind of funny. I don't know if it was faithful or not. I haven't seen that one. Got made into a stage play, like Joe's book, and then eventually it was made into a movie. And the movie is really pleasant. One of the complaints about her work is that it doesn't have plot. She called her own plays plotless charm. Which is
it's kind of like this podcast.
Yes.
It's also extremely charming.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's very charming to say my plays are plotless charm. So the movie manages to kind of like bring the plot, the story, the conflict to the front. And it also makes it not be too much of a downer. It's not like, well, I'm going to cry now. It's actually, it puts the sweet in bittersweet. But I have a question for you guys. Okay. Mm-hmm. And this is a question which has been battering around in my mind ever since we did Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
The epistolary form. Is the epistolary form dead? So like the written word is broadcast differently nowadays. We text, we email, we telephone call. Sometimes we Skype a podcast.
My friend, if you want to just pick up a movie called You've Got Mail, that is right up your alley. So you are going to love it. You're going to think to yourself, nope, it's not dead. And it's a movie that came out. Post-internet.
22 years ago. I'm saying now. Yeah. I'm saying like today in the era of TikTok and Skype and Snapchat and Twitter's fleets and just everything seems ephemeral. Like the thing she does at the end of this book is collect all of her letters.
Okay. So
and you can't really do that with your disappearing Instagram stories.
I read a book over the summer. I found it in a bookshop, in a used bookshop. It was called The Ship of Theseus. And it was a book
You're only allowed to recommend one book per episode. Okay.
So this is your book.
This is your book now. You have to present this one.
Damn, I'm not sure if it has an adaptation. But The Ship of Theseus was like, it's kind of this crazy premise where like the whole premise of the book is this book that you bought was a book that was found in a used bookstore, and the entire story takes place in the marginalia. It's two people who are writing back and forth to each other in the margins of this book. So while reading it, you have like the book itself, like the story that is The Ship of Theseus, but then you also have these two people writing in two different colored inks, like having a conversation about what's going on in the text, and there's like this mystery to it. And that felt epistolary to me. Like here they are writing letters back and forth asynchronously. And I thought that was a recent thing that I had seen done that was really cool and really interesting, like a really neat thing to do with the genre.
Yeah, I mean, I know the answer you want.
What answer
do
you think?
This is the trick that teachers play.
He wants the old man answer. I know the answer he wants.
What's the old man answer?
Yeah, well, nothing is as impactful as quills written on
letters. He's not saying that.
Carried by ravens. It's just not romantic like it used to be.
No, yeah. Nick. I am not saying that.
Leadheads, I have it on authority that Ian seals his letters with wax and a signet ring. You've heard it here.
I've seen
first.
It.
Wax
I'm not
and a
that cool.
Ring.
Nick, I am not looking for that answer.
Are you trying to say that Gen X can't be romantic, Ian? What's your problem?
I think the epistolary form could be dead as a literary form, and that's fine. Like we have really good ones.
And we're good, right?
We have other good stuff.
We have other good stuff. Like
we have TikTok. We don't need an entire genre of literature.
I might be in the minority there, but if things come and go, genres and forms come and go, and if like this is it for like if TikTok finally killed the epistolary star, well, okay,
a formidable enemy.
Gina, thank you for recommending this. It's short. I powered through it quickly, and I'm so glad I read this. It's a book that like I feel like a richer person, a richer human being for having read it.
That's a good book.
I love it, and I appreciate the recommendation. Litheads, this is what happens sometimes. Sometimes maybe you change our lives a little bit.
I feel richer by proxy. So
yeah,
thank you, Gina.
Yeah.
Hey, Litheads, I'm going to give you a little tiny, tiny peek behind the curtain here. Just like a brief glimpse. Here it is. Mm-hmm. There are some books that Joe and I both really, really want to talk about. And we kind of rush toward that book like rabid dogs snarling towards a piece of spoiled meat in an alleyway. And
or flesh meat. Too.
Yeah. Or yeah, maybe not the rabid dogs. Maybe they're like finally bred Alaskan Malamutes. The point is, Joe and I sometimes kind of race to get to a book.
Maybe and a small rodent.
At those points, when we realize we're racing toward a book, we very honorably stop, look at each other and say, let's both do it.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So this pop-out cop-out is one of them. We both want to talk about Jane Eyre, and so we're gonna.
Jane Eyre Week. Guys, Jane Eyre Week.
Jane Eyre Week. It's like Shark Week, but with more house fires.
I don't know anything about this book.
Well, that's why you're here.
That's why I'm here. Joe, everything I know about this book, play, movie,
mm-hmm.
I know from...
From me?
A Simpsons episode.
Oh,
excellent. So, much like Sean Connery,
yes.
You're a big fan of The Simpsons and are interpreting the world through Simpsons lens.
Yes.
Great.
And that's it. There's a whole episode
I'm
going to
be
this.
Totally honest with you. If you have seen that, like, you know quite a bit about it. Like that Simpsons episode, you know, that's back when Simpsons was really smart. Remember how it...
Yeah, when it was good, yeah.
Maybe it is still a smart show. I don't know. But
it's not.
That's when it was really smart. And that is it's a pretty good adaptation.
Yeah. Okay, this is what I know about it.
Yep, let's hear it.
There's, in this play, mm-hmm. sounds like there's going to be a couple lovers.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep,
so
lovers.
This is what I know based on Simpsons. This is my speculation here.
Got it.
There's going to be one female lead and mm-hmm. two male lovers.
Okay.
One is like maybe the good option, and one is maybe the bad boy.
Okay. Mm.
Or the more desirable, you know,
mm-hmm, yeah.
option. I don't know if any of this is true.
No, you're doing great.
And they just scream Stella all the time.
They do,
So it's like Stella is kind of maybe at the grocery store, and she has two choices for mayonnaise. One mm-hmm. of them is Hellman's Premium Select, and the other is Great Value.
Kroger brand.
Kroger brand.
Oh, man. There's some things you don't go cheap on. It's ranch dressing.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
And mayonnaise.
Yep.
Get Hidden Valley and get Hellman's.
Yep.
It's just no looking back.
There are probably other things that you don't go cheap on as well, but ranch dressing and mayonnaise is a good spot to start.
I don't think so. Those are the only two I can think
those
of.
Those are the two. Okay.
Hey, Litheads, write in.
Oh, baby formula.
Litheads, get in touch with us. Tell us what you don't go cheap on.
Yeah.
There you go. All right.
Tweet
Nick,
us.
Let me tell you the things that you got right and the things that you got wrong. Let's start there.
Okay.
It is a play. Ding, ding. You get a play point. It is a play about lovers. Ding, ding. You get a lover's point.
Nice.
It does have a female lead. You get a point for that. You're going to have to take away a point, Nick, because it does not have two male lovers in it. There are three characters.
One.
There are three characters at like the front of this play. Three main characters-ish, if you will. But it is one male and two females.
Gotcha.
And it is definitely, definitely about a bad boy. So, Nick, Nick, that was pretty good. That was one, two, three, four correct things and one misconception.
Did they yell Stella all the time?
Oh, 1 second. I'm going to give you 2 points
baby.
For Stella. Yeah, five things, baby. Can I tell you a quick story about Stella? I always use this.
Please do.
Okay. So, I have a very good friend.
I tune in every week.
Yep.
Yeah, Joe's stories.
I have a very good friend who I'm sure does not listen to this show. He has a daughter. He has two sons and one daughter, and he named his daughter Stella. And when I found out he was naming his daughter Stella, I of course said,
you were that guy.
I was that guy. I said, Litheads, here's a little advice for you. Never say the first thing that comes to your head.
Great advice.
Yep. Especially when you hear somebody's name for the first time, you're going to think of a good joke. Do not say it because they have heard it 1,000 times. Well, he said his daughter's name was Stella, and I, of course, yelled, Stella!
Right in his face.
Right in his face. And he looked at me, and he said, why does everyone keep saying that? And Litheads, that is why it is so important to read books. Because someday you, too, might name your daughter Stella. And if you do, people are going to yell Stella at that girl the rest of her life.
This is my son, Frodo.
Okay, so Nick, Let me give you a little bit of background for this play, because this was written as a play. It was written by a guy named Tennessee Williams. Tennessee Williams, first of all, really cool name.
Incredible.
He was a playwright, and he was a famous playwright in his life. He wrote Hot Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, which you may have heard of. He wrote The Glass Menagerie, which you may have heard of. But his most famous play, I think his most enduring play, is Streetcar Named Desire. He was super famous in his lifetime. He was like a bit of a celebrity in his lifetime, and he was kind of an interesting dude.
Was that his real name?
It is not his real name. His real name is Tom Lanier Williams, but I think we can all agree that Tennessee is a lot cooler.
Did he dabble in country music or?
Oh, no, I'm going to go out on a limb and say he would have disliked country music. Knowing what I know about Tennessee Williams, he was a very fancy boy.
What are you trying to say? You can't be fancy and like country music?
Some of like my best country people are fancy. Like, have you seen the Rhinestones?
People I know. Yeah.
I'd like to introduce you to my friend Rhinestones.
Right. Or like those, like that cool stitching around the pockets of jeans, right? Like that's very fancy.
Very fancy.
First of all, I want to draw a line. A line in the sand.
Okay. Figuratively.
There are characters in A Streetcar Named Desire. The main ones that we need to know are three of them. Stanley Kowalski, Stella Kowalski, his wife, and Blanche DuBois, his wife's sister.
Man.
Yeah. And his wife's sister is from out of town. She is from the South, and she is from a South that is crumbling. But like post-Civil War South has fallen to pieces. Like they live on this big, beautiful plantation and they have lost the plantation. Blanche is kind of the last in a line of Southern gentry.
Okay.
I want to start by talking about these guys just to give you a quick overview of the plot. But then...
Yeah, I guess we should hear about the book.
Yeah. So Stanley and Stella are married. They live in New Orleans. Stanley is very common. Right. He's like he was in the army. He's like an engineer, but not an engineer like we think of it today. Like, I think he just like makes stuff with his hands kind of. And Stella is from this wealthy, genteel Southern family, and she is married to Stanley. And it's clear from page one that Stella is slumming it like. Yep.
I've got a question here. You said he's common. Are you suggesting he's played by the rapper, actor, and activist Common? Or
is that what you're trying to say?
So if there is an adaptation with Common playing Stanley Kowalski, I have not seen it.
Okay. So it might be a new version out there, Ian.
Probably. Right. I'm certain.
Maybe you can bring that next week.
Common, we know you listen to the show.
Right.
You know, we'd love a shout out or to if you would act in this play is another option you could do. Thank you.
That'd be great. Thank you, Common. Okay. Stella's lost the plantation, right? Stella's lost Belle Reve, beautiful, beautiful dream. She's lost the plantation and she needs to move in with her sister and her husband in this like one room, two room apartment in New Orleans. And it causes problems, as you might imagine.
Yeah. Yep. I feel like this is going towards adultery. How fast are we going to get there? Sex, Joe.
You're talking about sex. I didn't know what the word adultery meant.
Let me spell it out for you.
So one of the things that makes this play cool, and this isn't what makes it like a faithful adaptation, although that's part of it, but like, this play is really about sexual attraction. Like that is like a large current running through this play. Stella loves Stanley. And she doesn't just love Stanley. She's like crazy about her husband, Stanley. But when you read the play, when you read the stage notes, when you watch Elia Kazan's adaptation of this on film, it is clear that like the attraction between them is a physical attraction. Like it is a magnetism between them.
It gets freaky.
It gets a little freaky.
I'm sure that's tough to manage in a 1.5 bedroom apartment.
And especially because Blanche, our friend Blanche, is a lady. She is a Southern lady, right? She is used to gentlemen courting her. She is used to being demure. Like that is what courtship means to her, right? That is not the relationship between Blanche and Stanley. Not only is Blanche and Stanley's relationship like hypersexual, it's also like really abusive. Like, less fun. Wah, wah.
Oh, here's that downer. What's the premise? Round out the premise. What's the dynamic then when she comes?
So basically the whole premise is Blanche shows up. She finds out that her sister is slumming it and she doesn't.
What does the sister teach us, Joe?
Yeah. So Blanche shows
up. What is the overt lesson?
She finds out her sister is slumming it and she basically wants her sister out of here. She wants her sister gone. But the problem is Blanche and Stella, they don't really have any other options. Nor does Stella like really want to leave. Like she really likes Stanley, you know, like you know how abusive relationships are. Like that's the thing. Like she really likes him. She kind of needs him, etc.
So Joe, I have one question for you.
Yes.
There's three characters.
Yep.
Yep. Three main characters. How many of them, your choices being 0, 1, 2, or 3.
Yep.
Learn something in the end.
Oh boy.
Do all of them learn something or just one or two? Or you don't even have to say which characters.
Or do we as the viewers or learn something from their inability to learn?
Even if they don't learn, we might learn.
And Joe, I will remind you of the rule about spoilers.
Yeah. Yes, I don't know how to answer this. Okay, this is what I would say.
Take your time
and
go slowly.
I would say, let's start with Stanley. Does he learn something? No. Stanley does not learn anything. Stanley is...
We're at zero still.
We're at zero. Yeah, I'm just going to skip right to the end. I don't think any of them learn anything. However, I do think the viewer learns an awful lot.
The lithead.
I do want to talk about the adaptation of this, because I think that's some of the most interesting stuff about this.
Hang on. Sorry, before you turn to the adaptation...
Yes.
I'm not a kind of guy. Listen, if I pick up a book that says, drive your tractor over the teeth of the dam.
Yeah. Your favorite.
I might not necessarily expect there to be tractors and teeth and the dam. Here damned. We
go. Right.
Uh-oh, here it comes, everybody. Oh,
here we go.
Okay. Here it comes.
I'm hearing a lot of desire.
Here it goes.
Mm-hmm. And I'm also hearing 4. Yeah. Which of these characters is secretly a streetcar in disguise? And what happens when that comes out?
Yeah. That's so good. Okay.
Who's the character desire?
Well, they all kind of desire one another. It's a little bit of a menage a trois, right? It's a little bit of like Stanley really likes Stella. And Stella really likes Stanley. And Blanche really hates Stanley, but he's pretty sexy. Like, he's pretty attractive.
Hold on. Is he the streetcar?
And not only that, Stanley really hates Blanche, but her looks are okay, I guess. That's a quote from the play. Your looks are okay,
Are streetcars sexy, Joe? Answer the question. We did brush past abusive relationship quite quickly.
Yeah. This is not a love story.
How big of a piece of shit is Stanley? Is he a dick?
Okay. He is a bad dude. Like
he's an actual bad dude, not like a charming Marlon Brando bad dude.
Okay. This is the thing. Stanley's a bad dude. He, however, is likable. Right. That's like the main tension when it comes to Stanley. Like, he's bad to his wife. He seems like he loves his wife, but all abusers love their wives, guys. He loves his wife, but he's bad to her. He's horrible to her sister.
Oh, really? Okay.
But the whole time, like, you kind of like Stanley. Like, he's kind of funny and he's like super masculine and like he's a engaging character, even if he's a bad character.
Would you say this is some of Mr. Tennessee Williams' victory in that this character who ought to be maybe a caricature, in fact, has a degree of likability and humanity?
We talked earlier about charisma, right? Charisma goes a long way. Stanley is charismatic for all the bad stuff that he does.
So in the world of adaptations, like he's a pretty good looking, charming guy in the book too. And obviously Marlon Brando is his own universe.
Yeah, so I
so
do
that
wanna,
translates.
It translates perfectly. In fact, but I do want to talk about two of the best casting decisions maybe in the history of cinema. Marlon Brando was this, he was Stanley Kowalski from the very beginning. He was Stanley Kowalski on Broadway, and I cannot imagine somebody being Stanley besides Brando. Like, he has this almost animal magnetism to him on screen, right? Like, it is.
Joe.
Can I talk? The other brilliant casting decision is a woman named Vivian Leigh. So Vivian Leigh was famous at 23 years old. She won the Oscar for playing Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind. So she won the Oscar at 23 years old for playing this like charming, beautiful Southern belle on this plantation in Civil War era South. Blanche DuBois is an aged Southern belle who is like washed up. Her beauty has left her. She's a very tragic figure. She's a woman who her entire life, the only thing of value, these are the play's words, not mine, but her only thing of value that she's had to give to the world is her femininity. Her femininity, her beauty, her grace. And that all is slowly leaving her as she gets older and older. When Elia Kazan made this into a film, when he took it off Broadway and he made it into a film, he kept every single actor from Broadway. So Brando came over and played Stanley Kowalski, right? The only person he replaced was the actress who played Blanche DuBois. And he replaced her with Vivian Leigh because he said that woman won an Oscar for Gone with the Wind when she was 23 years old. She is now older. She is now less beautiful. She is now less glamorous. If I'm going to have somebody play an aging Southern belle, like a Southern belle whose charm has left her, it has to be Vivian Leigh. And that's who plays Blanche in the film. And it is like perfect. It's absolutely awesome.
Joe, I have a one-star review for you.
Love it.
Well, not so much for you, but for the book that you brought.
are people reviewing me on Amazon
now? Somebody weighing
now?
In on your value.
Sebastian writes, full of sexism, racism, homophobia, and even pedophilia in one instance. So this one was definitely not my favorite. I get that it could not. I could not really expect a perfect and inclusive story due to the time it was written, but still, it made me feel very uncomfortable. And I just did not enjoy it. So, Joe, I guess my question for you is, what's wrong with you? Mm-hmm. Okay. Why do you like this book?
Yep, no problem.
Where do you get off?
I'm going to respond to Sebastian's points one by one. Does it have sexism? Yes, but that's part of the point. That's the point. It's a theme. Does it have racism? I don't know. I think it's actually pretty inclusive. Like, for the time, they live in the French Quarter of New Orleans. It's like this super diverse place. They're kind of friends across the spectrum with all people of races and classes. So I'm not as sure about racism. Does it have pedophilia? Yeah, but
Joe, are you defending pedophilia now, or are you saying that these themes are not in the book?
Can I try and save yes. Joe? I don't know why I'm doing this, but
he needs it more than ever.
I read this play before. Here's the thing, like Tennessee Williams plays don't just represent like the good parts of life, and the representation of the nasty stuff, like for instance sexual assault, it's like a huge thing. It's like a huge bad thing. This is not like, oh ha ha, then there was an assault and it's all good, and in fact he's pretty great for doing that. It's like a morally complex issue, and we've talked on the show about like, oh well, like this author was a Nazi, so maybe they should be canceled. I think there's a difference between saying like this book glorifies something like assault or, I don't know, sexism or racism, and this
don't forget pedophilia
or pedophilia. There's a difference between that. It glorifies it like a book like Pimp might, and it presents it as a complex, and negative, real part of the world we live in.
So I think it's fun. I think both of you are so off on this. Mm-hmm. I think this is a shit one-star review. I mean, is he giving those things one stars?
Like, yeah, basically, that's obviously sexism is bad. Obviously, racism is bad. But like that's. But I think one of the things Williams does is he's like, hey, this is kind of the world. Like, this is like, like Stella is with Stanley because that's Stella's choice. Like she doesn't have other options.
Sebastian ends with, it made me feel very uncomfortable and I just did not enjoy it. Mm-hmm. I got some advice for you, Sebastian. That's not a bad thing.
Yeah. Hey, Sebastian, that's the point.
Books should make you feel uncomfortable sometimes.
There is some content which, for whatever reason, folks are unable to consume. Like,
yeah.
If you have undergone something and
non-starters,
and rereading representations of that thing make you undergo further trauma, you shouldn't have to read it. And this goes back to our conversations about like assigning problematic books in our classrooms.
Yeah, it's a no-no.
So like there are some things which like just because it's there doesn't mean people ought to necessarily read it. But the other end of the spectrum is in play too. Just because it's a thing that makes someone uncomfortable doesn't necessarily mean it ought not to be written about.
Right. It shows a world that is real and maybe full of sexism and racism and homophobia and all those things. But like, I think one of the reasons that it is appealing, one of the reasons it works, is because you put yourself in the shoes of Blanche DuBois. You put yourself in the shoes of Stella Kowalski and you think like, yeah, Stanley, like he's kind of terrible, but like, I also kind of get why Stella likes him. Right. Like, and like, that's what works both in the play, but boy, on the screen, it's almost undeniable. Like when you see Vivian Leigh, when you see Stanley Kowalski, right? Like you really do feel it, right? And that's, of course, the difference. There's a difference between knowing something in your head and feeling something in your chest. And when you watch it on film, mm-hmm. right, you feel it in your chest. And that's why I would recommend this adaptation.
Blanche DuBois is maybe a better name than Tennessee Williams.
Blanche DuBois is pretty tough. Good. Yeah,
it's
Blanche
tough.
DuBois is pretty good.
We never cleared up the matter of Tennessee Williams' name. Is it Tennessee Williams or Tennessee Williams?
Oh, right. No, it is Tennessee Williams. His first name is Tennis.
Scholars say that there are many iterations, and we'll just never, really never know.
We'll yeah, never know.
It's kind of one of the great mysteries, you know?
Right. It's like a metaphor.
It's like a metaphor, Ian.
I stand corrected. It's like a metaphor. Listen, litheads, we've given you, we gave you one peek behind the curtain.
Just tell them what to do.
Now, if you want to help us in our adaptation process, like Gina did this week, you can head over to one or all of our social media channels, which is at You Don't Know Lit on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and you can give us a book recommendation. You could also head out to our website, which is youdontknowlitpodcast.com, and write a book recommendation there.
Streetcar Named Desire is one of those movies and of course books that's kind of like on my list.
Yeah,
and I'd say this is on that.
Yeah, Nick, I think you should just watch it. Like it's a pretty short movie. It's like an hour and a half. It's really good. Just watch it. Like,
yeah, but Joe,
Nick, you watched like 8 Nora Ephron movies last week and watch Streetcar Named Desire. It, you could do it before bed tonight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I am gonna do that, but you do lose, Joe. So I'm going to challenge myself with maybe reading a book that I haven't heard about before and maybe one that I have absolutely no attachment to.
Hey, Nick. Let me get clean audio.
That's the worst, Joe.
That is one of the worst sounds I've ever heard. Dreadful.
That was Joe's shirt.
Stella!
I imagine him hulking out.
Yeah. If the Hulk was a whiny little bitch, you just cried.
Not nice. Ian, please read your quote.
Okay, I'm gonna put an end to this suffering. This is a really wonderful quote. This is from a letter that Helene Hanf wrote to...
Ian, read us a quote.
Yes, I'm going to. I'm going to.
Fantastic.
This is from a letter to, she says, to all at 84 Charing Cross Road. April 16, 1951. To all at 84 Charing Cross Road, thank you for the beautiful book. I've never owned a book before with pages edged all round in gold. Would you believe it arrived on my birthday? I wish you hadn't been so over-courteous about putting the inscription on a card instead of on the flyleaf. It's the bookseller coming out in you all. You were afraid you'd decrease its value. You would have increased it for the present owner and possibly for the future owner. I love inscriptions on fly leaves and notes in margins. I like the comradely sense of turning pages someone else turned and reading passages someone long gone has called my attention to.
Congratulations. Congratulations, Ian.
I like that. That's why they call it literature.
That's why they call it literature.